Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith.
It really doesn't hurt the economy to carry a debt for a while. The U.S. federal debt has been carried for 200 years. The debt has not been paid off since 1835.
Ellen Brown joins us once again to talk about her latest piece in truthout.org, titled Why Banks Aren't Lending, The Silent Liquidity Squeeze. Ellen Brown's latest book is Web of Debt, online at webofdebt.com. She's chair and president of the educational nonprofit think tank publicbankinginstitute.org, and she's been recommending the state banking system in place in North Dakota that she says has made that state solvent. In the time since we last spoke with her in 2009, 14 states have initiated bills to establish state-owned banks or study their feasibility. Ellen Brown, welcome.
Thank you, Dori.
Just explain what a liquidity squeeze is so people understand.
Most people think that banks lend the deposits of their depositors, and therefore they always have the money that they lend. But that's not actually how it works. Banks create money on their books. They advance bank credit, and that goes into the borrower's account. And then when the borrower writes a check on that account, the check has to clear. And in order to clear, that's when they borrow from the depositors. And if they don't have enough money in the depositors, their own depositors' accounts, then they borrow from the other banks or the money market or various other liquidity sources. So this is called liquidity. And one of the factors in whether they will make a loan is what the cost of funds is to the bank. In other words, what the interest rate is going to be if they borrow from these other banks. So it's very important for them to know that they have access to that liquidity, particularly if a local bank is giving a credit line to a small business. They never know if they have credit lines to many businesses. They don't know which of these businesses is going to need credit at any particular time. Many businesses might put in a demand for credit at the same time, and the bank would not have the deposits to cover the outgoing checks, and therefore they would need to tap up the Fed funds market, which is the market where banks lend to each other their excess reserves, or the money market, et cetera. So if they can't get that money, then they're not going to risk making the loan. And right now we have basically a freeze on small business lending. Many small businesses say they just can't get loans at all anymore, and it's not because of a change in their business. It's something that has changed in the banks. The banks are not willing to lend anymore, and this appears to be a major factor that the interbank lending market has frozen.
What about large businesses? Because they seem, in some cases, to be hoarding cash. Is that right?
Large companies are able to issue their own bonds, so they don't have trouble raising money. So that's another problem. It's the small businesses that tend to hire. They're the ones that hire new employees. That's where our new employment comes from. And so if they're not hiring, then that's why employment has fallen off.
And I understand that since the time you've spoken with us, the idea you've been sharing nationally of a state bank has really taken off.
Yes. Well, there's one state only that has a state-owned bank, and that's North Dakota. And it's the only state that has escaped the credit crisis. In fact, it has the highest employment rate in the country, the lowest unemployment rate. They have the most local banks per capita. The business is booming. They have a huge budget surplus, where all these other states are desperately scrambling to try to balance their budgets, which they can't seem to do. North Dakota was in the enviable position of trying to decide what to do with the excess money. Should they slash taxes? Or should they add services, or should they build extra infrastructure? And the Bank of North Dakota is an instrumental factor in all that. They do have oil in North Dakota, and some people say that's the reason that they're doing so well. But you need infrastructure to service oil, and that's what the Bank of North Dakota does. They service the energy industry. They service the agriculture industry. They give very low-interest loans to farmers, startup farmers particularly. And they give a credit line to their own state government. So the state doesn't have to worry if they go a little over budget. They just tap up their credit line with their own bank, and they get the money interest-free since they own the bank. So we now have 14 states with bills pending either to form a state-owned bank on that same model or to do a feasibility study to see what the possibilities are for that state.
You have really pointed out in this piece in Truth Out that in addition to the problem of money coming to small businesses, what we've seen is a huge amount in TARP that went to companies for, you know, the various types of bailouts. And then we also saw the Federal Reserve's quantitative easing. Why don't you explain, first of all, what those two things were and whether or not they succeeded or failed in terms of stabilizing the economy, but then what they really have meant?
They were sold as being necessary because there was a liquidity freeze and that therefore banks weren't lending. But a study from MIT showed that there actually wasn't that the banks really were lending to each other until October. It wasn't right after Lehman collapsed. It was in October that this freeze on interbank lending started. And that was when the Federal Reserve started paying interest on excess reserves. That's the gist of my article, is that here's one factor that hasn't really been looked at, that the reason the banks aren't lending to each other is because they can get the same interest rate from the Federal Reserve. So why should they take the risk that some other bank might not pay them back? And they can keep their reserves and still get paid 0.25% interest, which is what the Fed funds rate is. So that seems to be a major factor in this credit freeze. But what TARP was supposed to do, this was money that bought toxic assets off the banks. So it got them off their books and supposedly freed up their capital. And then what quantitative easing 1 and 2 did, quantitative easing 1 also went for toxic assets. And then quantitative easing 2 was supposed to be a purchase of federal securities by the Federal Reserve. So quantitative easing is where they basically print money, and they don't really print it. They just write it into an account. But they basically just create credit on their books and use it to buy something. So in QE1, it was toxic assets, mortgage-backed securities that nobody else wanted. And in QE2, it was federal securities. But in both cases, what we now have, instead of having a lot of extra credit flowing around in the Main Street economy, you know, the local economy, what we have is $1.6 trillion worth of excess reserves just sitting on the books of the banks. And the Fed itself is scratching its head and trying to figure out what went wrong here. So I'm arguing that the reason that those excess reserves aren't moving into the economy is that they are all on the books of certain large banks, which have no incentive to lend them to the small banks, which are the banks that lend to local business. And the big banks aren't lending to local business. They're using all these perks that they got out of the bailout to speculate or to trade. You know, most of their money comes from trading for their own accounts. That means investing in largely speculative ventures, often ventures that hurt the local economy. For example, they might invest in foreign companies that compete with our companies, or they might invest in commodities, driving up the price of commodities and making them more expensive for our businesses. So it hasn't worked out the way it was planned, but then the question is why. One reason that the money in quantitative easing, too, the reason it wound up on bank reserve accounts rather than going to the government, which was where you would think it would go if they bought federal securities, is that the way the legislation is set up, the Federal Reserve is not allowed to buy government bonds directly from the government. They have to buy them on the open market from these 20 specific bond dealers, which are all banks. And 12 of the 20 happen to be foreign banks. They're foreign banks with branches in the U.S., like Deutsche Bank, you know, those big foreign banks. And so they, as it turned out, won the auction. They sell them at auction. So the Fed doesn't even have a choice over who it sells to. It just sells at the best bid it takes. So the foreign banks wound up with the money, and the Federal Reserve wound up with the bonds. So the government didn't actually get the money that you would have expected, that the bond dealers would buy more bonds with it, but they didn't, because they need the dollars themselves, the euro dollars, for, first of all, they have a credit crisis themselves in the EU, and second of all, they can use that for, there's a carry trade where, because our interest rate has been set so low now by the Federal Reserve for the interbank lending, the banks can get this very cheap money at 0.25%, and then they can invest in their own currencies at a much higher interest rate, and then they just keep the spread. So that's a nice profit for them.
Give us a hierarchy. Who's winning? Who's losing? And what do the different people talking about ways to solve these problems tend to be offering? I mean, it seems as if you look at it in a black and white way, one side wants to strengthen corporations further, strengthen the banks and Wall Street. Another, you know, and corporations, of course, now are people. They can, you know, contribute a lot of money to political campaigns. That's a factor. But it seems really as if we're seeing, in terms of the tax debate and other kinds of questions about bank regulation, that we've got sides drawn where one side favors free market industry, letting corporations do what they want to or need to increase their growth, whereas the other side is looking more to protect society and protect the American taxpayer, the voter, or, you know, at least respect the rights of people in other countries. Is that fair? I mean, can you describe, first of all, who's winning? How does this work? And what are the sides looking like?
Mm-hmm. Well, the bottom line is the rich are getting richer and the middle class is being squeezed out altogether. The middle class is being reduced to the lower levels, that they're losing their jobs. And the whole point of the bailout was supposed to be to keep credit flowing to the local economy, and that simply has not worked. In fact, it's worked in reverse. The credit situation is worse for the local economy now than it was before. That's why, to me, there's not much hope of fixing things at the federal level. I mean, they may be operating with the best of intentions, but I think they've got their theories wrong. And the other possibility is they're not operating with the best of intentions. I mean, Wall Street is obviously influencing their decisions, and all the decisions are working in favor of the big banks, and they're squeezing out the small banks, and they're squeezing out the small businesses, particularly where jobs originate. So I think that's why we have to work at the local level and why the state bank idea is a good idea. Basically, in North Dakota, the Bank of North Dakota is serving as the central bank, like the Federal Reserve does, but the Federal Reserve is not serving the local banks or the state and local government. And in North Dakota, the Bank of North Dakota does serve the government, and it serves the local banks, and the local banks then serve the local economy. So I think we need a new model, and if we could set up a local model, like if every state had its own state bank where it could turn for credit to keep its credit flowing, then we could let the big banks fail. They would no longer be too big to fail. And that's the way it should work in a capitalist economy. If you fail, you failed. And to have the government underwrite the banks and still let them keep their profits is just so obviously a distortion of either the capitalist model or the democratic model or anything that supposedly this country stands for.
Well, we can look at that in terms of a company like Goldman Sachs, right? I mean, Goldman has just won the right to keep its profits. And it's had something like $1.7 billion or $1.9 billion profit that it's reporting right now. The United States having bailed them out to the tune of billions of dollars. So is that the kind of company you're talking about?
Yes. And I suspect we're going to have another banking crisis because they didn't fix it. The Banking Reform Act that they passed last summer didn't really address the real cause of the problem, which was largely this liquidity problem. So the next time they have a banking collapse, will we bail them out again? I mean, we really can't. Obviously, we don't have the money. That's why I think it's very important that we set up an alternative model so that we don't have to bail them out. So they won't have the leverage they had before. We'll say, too bad. You know, you failed, so you failed. You profited from the capitalist model, and now you've lost under the capitalist model. You win and lose under the same system.
Some of the regulation has been controversial, again, coming to the political realm as opposed to the realm of what banks need or don't need. So just out of the political realm now, if you look at all of this, who has the ability to fix it? I mean, where should we turn for help in preventing another banking crisis?
That's why I think we have to do it at the local level, because I don't see it happening at the federal level, and I don't know how they can break through and make it happen. You're not going to get the big banks to give anything up, you know, the way they're operating now.
And you don't think that any of the proposed regulations or agencies that are new or, the federal government, Congress, can in any way, let's say, regulate the amount of lending that goes on somehow? I mean, can they incentivize it in a way?
They can't, no. They can't force the banks to lend. I mean, banks will do the thing that's profitable for their shareholders. And if they can't make money making loans, they will do something else, which is what they are doing. They're, instead of doing their ordinary loans at 8%, they're now doing credit cards at 16%, which is much more profitable for them. And things like raising the capital requirement, I think, will just hurt, because it's going to make it even more difficult, particularly for the local banks, which are the banks that have an interest in lending to local business.
And we should talk about the whole difference between a bank that can work internationally or interbank versus one that really has to work within its own set of either partners or companies willing to work with it. So there's a big difference there, right?
Right. The local banking system, actually, we've had the state versus federal conflict going on. There's been a rivalry going on ever since 1863. The federal system was set up. And even then, they were trying to get the state banks to join the federal system, and the state banks, they wanted to retain their independence. So the state banks came up with checking accounts. That's when checking accounts originated. And for years, it was debated whether checks were even money. And they kept failing, of course, because they were issuing money they didn't really have. And then the checking account was not even a secure thing until FDIC insurance came in the 1930s. But anyway, the reason the state bank set up the checking account system was to avoid having to pay a huge tax, which was what the federal system was requiring of them if they continued to issue banknotes. So instead of issuing banknotes, they issued checks, which were just like little receipts for trading money within the system. So anyway, you have these two competing systems, and it looks right now that the big banks are just taking over. Where I live, there were two local banks, which I had accounts in both of them. There were only two local banks, and now both one of them is U.S. Bank and the other is Chase Bank. I mean, they've both been taken over. We don't have any local banks where I live anymore, and I think that's true quite a few places.
And what about the policy that was implemented where banking regulators were working with the banks in terms of interest? I know interest has been held way down. How has that helped or hurt in terms of the whole policy?
The idea was that if you made it very easy for banks to lend, that that would encourage them to lend. But the problem was, it wasn't the inability to get funds from the other banks that was slowing them up, not originally. The reason lending had fallen off was that they couldn't meet the capital requirements because they had all these bad mortgages on their books that weren't paying. They had all these toxic assets, and so they wound up being what were called zombie banks. They couldn't make any new loans until the old loans had paid off. So it was something else that was freezing the system. So the thing that they were trying to fix was not actually a problem. But by agreeing to pay interest on the excess reserves, they suddenly made the interbank lending market a problem, because now the banks did not want to lend to each other. They had no incentive to lend to each other. Even if they have the best of intentions, they keep messing things up. So we don't want to rely on their system. That's why I think we need to set up our own local system. Banks create bank credit with deposits and capital. That's the two things they need to create bank credit. Well, every state has a huge amount of capital and a huge amount of potential assets if they put their own state revenues in their own bank, the way North Dakota does. So just by recapturing that credit potential in your own bank, you can then partner with the local banks and keep credit flowing in the state.
What about the question now of the Obama administration and the economy? Because his whole platform during his election campaign for his first years in office was that he was going to fix the economy. Can you define what that means, the economy? Because it seems to me that people don't have that as a concept very clearly in their minds. When they talk about the economy, some are talking about what people pay in taxes and how workers are doing and whether or not the government can pay its bills. And others are talking about Wall Street, banking, and whether or not they can make $100,000 that year in stocks.
Right. Well, that's the trouble. We have a two-tiered economy. And the upper tier is doing just fine. Wall Street keeps going up almost unbelievably, but it does, And the businesses, as you say, have lots of extra money sitting around, the big businesses, and Wall Street has recovered and it's done fine. If that's your measure, the economy is doing well. But if your measure is employment, many people, I was in Beverly Hills recently, and there were actually homeless sleeping in the doorways in Beverly Hills. I have never seen that before. I mean, there's always been homeless in downtown L.A., but not in Beverly Hills. We are turning into a third world country in some respects. I mean, there's that lower tier. If we cut off Social Security, we're going to be back to the depression conditions of the 1890s when they had no social safety net and people were sleeping in barns and in open fields and basically starving.
We're certainly facing very high unemployment in America and in other countries. And I want to speak again about corporations because they are going to have a strong voice in the next election. In 2012, they could give untold millions to congressional and presidential candidates. And so when you look at that, I mean, let's look at a company like Cisco. I believe they had something like 44 or 45 billion in reserves, which seems illogical for a company like that. But that's a technology company today. And so they've just issued a notice of laying off more than 6,000 workers, closing one of their plants in Mexico, I believe. So that's what's happening to workers. And yet the company has this incredible amount of cash. They're almost like a bank themselves.
Mm-hmm. You don't have any use for workers unless somebody wants your product. So you have to have demand. And that's how you would fix the economy, is to stimulate demand. And to do that, you've got to get money into the pockets of the consumers. And that means those people have to have jobs. They have to make money somehow. So the way to fix the economy would be for the government itself to go into business, basically. I mean, to build infrastructure, to hire people, to do different things. That's where it has to start. When the private economy is frozen, like it is, then the public economy has to put some money out there and get things flowing again. But the trouble is, we have this fear of allowing the government to go into debt. And so instead of allowing them to put more out there, in Congress, they're fighting over making them put less out there. And they're trying to balance the budget when what they should be doing is to try and stimulate jobs. Now, in China, they know this. And so in China, when they had the beginnings of a recession, they pumped money into the system and they started hiring for all kinds of things. I mean, they do things that they have empty shopping malls. They built these amazing shopping malls that nobody's using. And you could say, well, that was a waste of resources. But what it did was it put a lot of people to work, and those people now have wages in their pockets and they can go out and buy things. It's obviously also a fairly wasteful way to do it. But the ideal is to put them to work on things that we need. And there's so many things we do need right now. Well, in California, in L.A., the freeways are also rather like, I used to live in the third world, so I know the roads are falling apart. Like in the third world, the teachers have been laid off. Studies have shown that if you hire teachers, this is not an expenditure. This is an investment. That if you invest in the education of your children, they will get better paying jobs and they will pay more taxes and the government will make many times its investment over again in the future. So we need to invest in our future, which means we need to put some state credit, national credit. You can call that debt if you want, but really it's the credit of the nation. You need to extend that credit. The way businesses work, including the business of public work, is you've got to pay your workers and materials first before they can produce a product to pay back the loan. So you extend the credit, you pay the workers, you build the thing, and then you'll get your returns in the future.
And Ellen Brown, I know that in the state of Connecticut, we're seeing a lot of layoffs of government workers. This is something that's happening in other states as well, as the government literally downsizes its workforce at a time when we have one of the highest in record rates of unemployment. It's a strange process because we have a new administration in Connecticut anyway, and the Malloy government is now struggling to articulate its reasons. It's arguing that the you know, the unions in the state rejected his offer, and it's very complex in that sense. But in another sense, it's pretty simple. They don't have the money. They need to cut back. So they're firing people that do road work. They're firing people that work in the area of social services and closing some social services offices that are local satellites that served people who really needed that desperately. They are also closing motor vehicles offices. And they've also said they're going to downsize at prisons, and they're closing one in the state that I know of. So in all of that, what we're seeing is a reduction in infrastructure at a time when what we thought we were hearing from the Obama campaign was that they were going to use the need for infrastructure to create jobs.
Yeah. So let's assume, yeah, obviously the Obama administration, they're cutting back on the programs they have for helping the states fund their infrastructure and other projects. They're cutting back on that money. So the state has to do something for itself. So let's assume that the state set up its own bank, put its own revenues in that bank and its own capital in that bank instead of investing them in Wall Street. Then it can generate credit. So the state can extend basically interest-free loans to itself to build all this stuff, to build infrastructure. And because it owns the bank, it saves all the money on interest. That means you can go heavily into debt. If you don't have to pay interest, it really doesn't hurt the economy to carry a debt for a while. The U.S. federal debt has been carried for 200 years. The debt has not been paid off since 1835, almost 200 years. And it just keeps going up, and it hasn't hurt the economy because the debt is the money supply. You need debt. All of our money today is created as debt, credit or debt. It's no longer a commodity-based system where you dig the gold out of the ground and then that's your money. It's now an accounting system. So my credit is your debit. You've got to have both sides of this yin and yang of money in order to have an economic financial system under our current modern system, which is not a bad system. It's good. We had the wrong idea about it. We think that because we have to balance our own personal checkbook, that the government has to. But the government is the originator of the national credit and should be. And it needs, at a time when we're in a recession, it needs to get more of the national credit out there.
Let me ask you a question of whether or not corruption would be easier in a state bank versus the way the system is set up now in a state like Connecticut, because for a time we were known as Corrupticut, and that because the previous governor had gone ahead and, you know, dipped into the bond fund and used it for his different schemes that were going on at different times. Now, in that sense, would John Rowland have had an easier time of it with a state bank or a harder time?
The question is, would you trust a state bank more? First of all, your state bank is an independent body run by bankers. In North Dakota, they say that specifically. Don't let the development people get off. They say, we're not a development program. We are bankers. We make loans that are profitable loans. You know, we make loans like any bank does. We look at how the loan is going to get paid off, and if it's not going to be a sound loan, we don't make it. So this is an independent bank run by bankers, and the question is, would you rather have your state monies in an independent bank that you own that is going to return its profits to you and that has a mandate to serve your community, or would you rather have your money in a Wall Street bank that you have absolutely no control over and that has no mandate to return anything to you?
Ellen Brown, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me. It was great talking to you.
Ellen Brown is author of the book Web of Debt. Her article on Why Banks Aren't Lending, The Silent Liquidity Squeeze, appears in truthout.org July 15th. You can learn more online at webofdebt.com or publicbankinginstitute.org. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program is produced in Storrs, Connecticut, and syndicated with Pacifica Network. TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts, audio, and discussions. Our music is by Fritz Heed.